You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
I'm John Burnham Schwartz, literary director of the Sun Valley Writers Conference, and this is Beyond the Page. In this episode, I talk with my good friend, Pulitzer Prize-winning playwright and novelist Eyad Akhtar, about his just-published new novel, Homeland Elegies. Passionate, disturbing, unputdownable, Salman Rushdie calls it, about being the American Midwestern son of immigrant doctors from Pakistan, about otherness and Islam and Trump and capitalism and identity and race, and, ultimately, the state of this country he calls home. It is my great pleasure to welcome my good friend, the playwright, novelist, screenwriter, Eyad Akhtar, for a conversation, particularly about his new novel, Homeland Elegies. I just want to say, starting out, that I read Homeland Elegies for the first time about 10 months ago, and at the time was full of admiration and thrilled and provoked and moved. And the book has stayed with me, but I just finished in the last 3 days rereading the book. And it's not often one rereads a book in such a short period of time. And my admiration has only grown exponentially. If I can think of one book in recent years that I would call necessary, I would say that about this book. It is a novel that packs the power of both great nonfiction and fiction. And it seems to tell us from many different places at once how we got to this moment in the American experience. And it suggests in certain hopeful and surprising ways, perhaps where we might go. So having said that, Eyad, welcome.
Thanks, John. You're going to make me cry.
Don't do that yet. Save it for the end.
Okay.
So I want to ask you, I could sit here and start describing this novel, which is very boldly structured. It has a kind of Rothian chutzpah to it in terms of how it tackles this question of American experience and of otherness in this country. But I would rather hear you describe how you see the book.
You know, I had been, you know, I think we've all been through a lot in the last few years, especially politically, but not only. I mean, I think I also had the misfortune of my mom passing away, and then a beloved mentor of mine, and my father was showing signs of pretty significant decline. And you know, that all of that combined with what was happening in America, I was in a certain mental state. I was emotional, mm-hmm. mental and emotional state. And I read a poem by Leopardi from, 200 years ago, mm-hmm. in which it's the first of his canti, and it's called To Italy, and he's addressing the Italian people. He's addressing his fellow citizens, his fellow countrymen. And, you know, it was a question that sort of ignited in me would it be possible to address my fellow Americans? Could I today find a voice that would reconstitute the us, if for no other duration than just the duration of anybody who read these pages? And, mm-hmm. you know, almost immediately, John, I mean, it was really shocking. It was really the next day I got up and there was a voice that was speaking. It was speaking the overture of the book, the very opening, the first four pages, which are in essence, really the entirety. It's the, you know, holographically, it's the entirety of the argument of the book and all of the major personalities of the book, or at least most of them.
Yep.
And so, you know, that kind of poured out of me. And then what ended up happening was, you know, I've had some pretty amazing creative experiences in my life, just in sort of, you know, surprising explosions and eruptions, but this was by far the most extraordinary. I mean, it was just, it was bizarre. It was, I would write for 2 weeks. I would have language that I didn't even know I had. I would have, you know, scenes. It was almost effortless, except in the sense that it required stamina to just keep going. And then I would, 2 weeks, I would stop. I would be exhausted. I would stop. I would think it had gone, and then it would suddenly reappear. And then I would go for another 2 weeks or 3 weeks, and then it would stop. And this lasted about 11 months. And, you know, the funny thing about it, you know, it's an organic structure in the sense that it doesn't present you with an obvious story from the get-go. You're really immersed in the confusion between truth and fiction and the narrator's various narrative threads that he is narrating to you. And so all of that stuff, believe it or not, I mean, I was surprised as I sort of, you know, got to the middle and then got to the end that there was as much coherence to the book as there was. And there I think is, that in a way, yeah. it spoke to maybe the coherency of what I have been thinking about for the last 10 years.
So there's a definite mix of memoir, if you will. It's certainly personal biography, family biography, and the facts of your own life and those of others in your family, mixed in with novelistic license. I mean, I know you well. Yeah. You're a good friend, and I still don't know in many cases where it ends and where it begins. You'll note also that I have not asked you until now. But how?
Well,
how
I think as time goes on, I may get confused about
I think that's healthy, personally. But what degree of awareness did you have from the beginning about what those boundaries were or were not going to be as you set out to write this book?
Thank you for that. That's probably the most important question surrounding the book for me, you know, at least in talking about it. I do want to just get back to the last question because I didn't really answer your question.
Yeah.
But, you know, sort of like the simple way of putting it is that I think I got to a point because of the personal and the political where I felt like I wanted to look back on what had happened to my parents and their generation of immigrants, mm-hmm. and all of their kids, meaning people like myself, and what happened to us in the 50 years that we had been here, and what happened to this country in those 50 years, and what the changes in America in that half century meant about what they thought they were coming to and what it ended up becoming, right? So mm-hmm. that's really the kind of like nutshell about it. That's what I should have answered in the last question. In, you know, this question, you know, to me, I always knew that I wanted to find the reader. I wanted to make an attempt to find the reader where they are today. I wanted mm-hmm. I wanted to write a book that was going to have the potential to have a certain kind of grit and bite that the audience and the readership is getting from social media, that they're getting from breaking news, that they're getting from the Instagram scrolls. I just felt that in my hands, a third person novel or a novel that was going to sort of like tell you a story that was just not, I wasn't going to be able to pull off the immediacy, the vividness, the attack, the sensationalism mm-hmm. of what's happened to the world. You know, this lust for unreality that has overtaken us politically and personally. And so I knew from the beginning that I was going to be writing into this nebulous space between truth and fiction because I wanted to find a form that was going to mirror the collapse of the boundary between truth and fiction. I didn't want to indict that collapse of the boundary. I wanted to use that collapse because I wanted to find a way to absorb the reader in an experience that maybe was you know, somewhat unprecedented for them.
I think that's exactly what you did.
I'm really pleased to hear that. I mean, I think the one thing, last thing I'd say about it is that I feel like in reality, what the book is in a kind of a literary attempt at reality television or reality serial entertainment or reality serial episodic, you know, mm-hmm. that I'm not trying to, in traditional autofiction, the narrator has a kind of arm's length distance from the events and kind of, you know, but this here, I'm trying to collapse the boundary between myself and the reader. So. Mm-hmm.
Well, you do quote Alison Bechdel in the epigraph, "I can only make things up about things that have already happened," which a line I really love,
right.
And so true. So let's look at the book. There are 8 major chapters, right? So there's a definite sense of a musical form with an overture in the beginning and even a coda at the end. And in the overture, you present an old college professor of yours, Mary Maroney, who's someone who I now think of as a friend of mine in some fashion, just because she stands out so vividly in the book. But you present her as something of an intellectual and moral Virgil, if you will, for you and also for us, the readers, as we all prepare to enter this dark wood of the contemporary American experience, which is going to be this book, this journey. And Maroney does, you know, she definitely turns out to be an extraordinary and illuminating guide. But it's a very important role. It's a spine for the book in a number of ways, and we return to her later. And it's a very effective device, even as much as she's a very realized character. So how aware were you at that moment that that was going to be the case? How did she come to inhabit this role? Which is also to say, what role did she play in your life?
She, you know, Mary Maroney is based on a teacher that I had in college who was really pivotal for me, and who's also named Mary, but she has a different last name, but Italian American, and really just a brilliant mind and somebody who she accorded me an equality in intellectual equality, as we would sit in her office for hours upon end, that was entirely not merited. I mean, I did not deserve that equality, but by according it to me, by sort of, you know, extending that invitation to meet her where she was, I think she really changed me. She's an important part of my intellectual development. I'm still in touch with Mary, and I still share work with her. She comes and sees everything I do. She's come to all the plays. She's given me critiques, and she's helped me get through some of the hardships. And you know, it was interesting with the overture when it came to me. Mary was at the top of it, and Mary's address about America just after the Reagan-Bush years, and you know, at the beginning of the Clinton years. I remember her perspective and feeling shocked by the things that she would say in class. And so I was just, it came to me in that overture. And I didn't know how much she would recur in the book. But I think as I was writing it, I kind of knew that there were certain strands I needed to keep alive. And so, you know, they would come as themes returned, as situations presented themselves. A lot of times I would find ways, or I found myself finding ways to, you know, bring characters back into the narrative.
Yeah.
In Mary's case, it was all pretty organic.
She becomes, too, a kind of guide in the book, linking the public sphere and one's critique of it with the unconscious and the private. And that's, the book very much inhabits that bridge.
Yeah. And the imagination as well.
Yeah. So let's start where the narrative essentially starts itself, which is with your family. As you talked about wanting the book to stand in a way as a remembrance of them and of what they lived, as well as what you lived. But it's especially your parents. I mean, there are many memorable relatives and family friends, but above all, there's your father and your mother. And first, I want to ask you a little bit about your own experience, because it's not just your parents and relatives in America, but it's very much also before America in Pakistan.
Yeah.
And what was your experience growing up with Pakistan, both the reality and the idea? And how did that connect in a way with your more present experience of growing up here in America as someone born here?
Well, it was a double picture that I always had. I always had a picture of one culture and a picture of another, and I was on the inside of both in a way, but I was also on the outside of both. And I think one of the things that it really made clear for me as a kid was that the things that people believe aren't universal. And so what the folks I was around here, what they believed, you know, seemed perfectly reasonable and absolutely probably true. But then when I would go home or when I would be in Pakistan with my parents, they believed completely different things and it felt just as viable. And so that contingency of belief is something that I think I've always been much more comfortable than maybe people understand why. I don't necessarily think there's any right way of looking at anything. And I think that just comes from this experience. And so in a way, I would say that, you know, notwithstanding whatever the difficulties of being you know, Muslim post 9/11, which of course the book, you know, goes into great detail, even though it ultimately is not making a case for any kind of exceptionalism of a point of view because of the sufferings one goes through socially. I think it, on the contrary, is suggesting that maybe we're all in it together as Americans. But, you know, notwithstanding all of those difficulties, I think that as an artist, I have embraced the perspective of the observer and the one on the outside taking a look and sort of making notes and trying to figure stuff out. You know, so I landed okay on, you know, this double consciousness, if you will, of two different cultures. And it's actually served me well.
Yeah. It certainly has. And you describe yourself there's a letter to the reader in the galley, you know, as a child of a generation caught between notions of home, of success, of belonging, and most of all of America. And that definitely brings me to your father, who is, he's just a character who leaps off the page and could easily yeah. command a novel of his own. And he's linked
well,
in this
book.
He
left off the page of life, John.
That is clear. And I'm sure he felt he deserved a novel of his own as well. So,
even though he would never read it.
No, of course not. But, yeah. You know, he's linked in this book from the beginning in a way that is surprising, funny, absurd, tragic, and bracing with Donald Trump. And without spoiling the book in any way, but it's not really a spoiler type of thing, do you want to just talk about that and what
sure.
what a portal your father was and the idea of him and the Donald together?
Yeah. So my father was a very well-known cardiologist and specialist, world specialist of arrhythmias, one of the pioneers. And was a doctor to many, many famous people over the years. And so the chapter, the sort of beginning of the book begins with an account of the narrator's father, who is, you know, substantially based on my father, who in the mid-90s treated Donald Trump briefly and was brought in on a case in which, you know, nobody could quite figure out what was going on with the irregular heart rhythms. My dad started coming to New York to treat Trump, and you know, didn't really develop a relationship with him, but just kind of in the book kind of has a bromance, if you will. You know, spends enough time to be kind of, you know, like enamored of the high life, the New York City high life, And this early experience, and then the medical problem is resolved, and you know, my father doesn't see Donald Trump again for, you know, 20 years. By the time he's running for president, but that early experience left such a positive impression on him, and sort of so enamored, such a romance, really, if you will, that he is a Trump supporter throughout the campaign, and this creates all kinds of trouble between me and him. But also there's some further consequences, pretty significant consequences on my father's life and on the family life based on his encounter with Trump, which get played out throughout the course of the book. And you know, one of the things that I was doing here was, of course, finding a way to get into the politics of today and to find a human way to actually begin to thread the various needles that I would have to thread in order to sort of paint the portrait of what America has become, why we are where we are, if you will.
Yep.
And so, you know, on the one hand, that first chapter, you know, puts us in contact or you know, gives us a feeling of America that is embodied by Donald Trump, a self-made man who makes himself, you know, on the strength of debt and the gap between appearance and reality, who may not, or is certainly not all that he claims to be, but who through the power of personality and positive thinking and whatnot is able to sort of vanquish, you know, any foe. And that in a way stands in for a kind of on steroids version of American opportunity, if you will, right?
Yep.
And that his ascension to the American presidency is really the ultimate success story, if you will, right? And on the one hand is that sort of overblown version of American, I'm not even sure what the right word is, individualism. And on the other side of it is the following chapter, which is my mother's anti-Americanism, which, comes from her own homesickness and also comes from her feeling that America doesn't understand her and where she comes from, and her sympathies for bin Laden. So between Donald Trump and bin Laden, there's a whole section that takes place in Abbottabad right about the time that bin Laden is actually staying in a compound just a few blocks from where the part of the book takes place. Between those two poles, between Donald Trump and bin Laden, is the portrait of America that unfolds inside the book.
That brings us to your mother, who is such an affecting and melancholy character in so many ways. And the sense of regret she carries, at least in the book, for a hidden, barely hidden love for your father's best friend, whom she did not marry and someone else did, and a sense that, a regret that somehow she had left there and brought you here even before you were born, and that somehow she had robbed you of some kind of happiness that in fact you didn't yourself see in that way. And there are just, as later in the book, as she's dying, her cancer has recurred. I just want to mention these two lines. One, you say in the novel, "In rejecting what she couldn't give me, hadn't I rejected what she could?" And the other one is, "I never felt like I had access," meaning to her, "except when we were in Pakistan." So yeah, just right. Those two lines, what would you say about that in terms of not only her, the arc of her life in Pakistan and then in America, but also what that left you with afterwards?
Yeah. You know, my mom, like the mother in the book, was caught in a country that I think she... I don't think she loved it very much. I don't think she found the bounty of whatever opportunity and so-called freedom. And I don't think she felt that made up for losing all the things that she had to lose in order to be here. Family and the native smells and tastes and sounds and what was so great about America anyway? It was just you could just have more stuff and that you could, the gadgets were cooler, and that, what was it? At root, mm-hmm. It was really just about money. And on the other side of the coin with my father, what was so great about it? Well, the fact that you could make all the money you wanted to, and you could do stuff with that money. So yeah. In a way, I think, I think that's one of the reasons money is at the heart of the book. But getting back to my mom, she, I think, was homesick most of her life. And I think there was a sense of regret. And I do think that she was a different person when we were in Pakistan. And I loved the person that she was there in some ways. Maybe I loved her equally, but I maybe liked that person more. And as far as, in wanting what she couldn't give me, I rejected what she could. Right.
Yeah.
And I think that's the essence of my relationship with my mother, unfortunately. I wanted something from her that she couldn't give me. And, I don't even know, and toward the end of her life, I guess I didn't even understand why it was I wanted that. Right. What was it? Why was it so important for me to want something that she couldn't give me?
So that always, when we get into the heart of that, which is so personal and emotional, one of the things I so appreciate about the book is that for every personal an emotional investigation of that kind, it leads inevitably, because of the nature of the book, to a thought about something larger, in this sense, mm-hmm. and more political, if you will. So when what you're saying about your mother, which is in rejecting what she couldn't give me, hadn't I rejected what she could, I'm also thinking about Islam and about right. your relationship to Islam. You're being a Muslim American vis-a-vis your parents' faiths or non-faiths, their relationship with it. And so I don't, I don't know that you and I have even talked that much about this in the past, but what your own personal experience of growing up with Islam in the Midwest, in America, with your parents and with your travels to and from Pakistan, family travels mostly, how did writing this book change your feeling about that? Also losing your mother, in this case, where do you feel you are now, relative to where you were then?
You know, I think that one of the things that I, in before writing this book, I'd been thinking about, because I'd been trying to write something and I had started and you know, it was a story about actually about my father, and thought I was going to write a short novel about my father. And you know, as I was writing early on, I could feel how no matter what I wrote, there was no way what I was going to, how I would be read would be read in any other way but through the lens of it being about a Muslim. Mm-hmm. That in this country, if I was to write about my father, there was no way to avoid one way or the other, even though he didn't identify as being Muslim, with Islam. That Islam was going to be a subject of the book one way or another, whether I wanted it to be or not, because the reader was going to bring that to it. And so in a way, I think one of the things that this book, or the narrative strategy of the book, or the voice of the book kind of solved for me, was to say, I'm going to write about America. I'm going to write about everything. But I know that you, reader, will probably wonder a lot, as I have also, what my relationship with Islam is. And because I'm writing about everything, I'm going to write about that too. Mm-hmm. So that's going to be there too. And so in a weird way, I kind of found the freedom to be free of Islam by writing about America and Islam and other stuff too. Donald Trump and syphilis and all kinds of stuff. And so somehow, you know, it feels in a way that, you know, Islam is an important part of my history, for sure. There's no question. I mean, it's such a big thing for me. But it's also not that big a deal, at least not to me. It's just part of the, you know, it's just part of my life.
And yet all the works you've done now and all of the dialogues you've gotten into publicly after Disgraced went on the stage and then won the Pulitzer, 8 years ago and 7 years ago. And so there's been this continuous conversation in a way that you have, on the one hand, instigated, but on the other hand, been forced to have, you know, about being a Muslim American, about whether your characters and your works are speaking for you, or are they just about Muslims Muslim Americans, or are they about America? And so it seems to me that this novel, in that sense, is I don't want to say an answer, but it is a response.
No, I think that's exactly right. Yeah. John, no, that's exactly right. Mm-hmm. I mean, I've been hounded by that question. You know, it's nice that people care enough for me to be able to say something like, I've been hounded by a question as a writer, right? like I'm grateful, but the reality is I've been hounded by this question of accounting for myself as a Muslim in this country for 10 years now. You know, I haven't chosen to write about Islam. I'm just writing about my experience. I can't write. I mean, it would be odd for me to take on the voice of, you know, I don't know, some Southern person living in Alabama and just writing I wouldn't have the only thing I really know granularly is the experience that I have had and that of my family. So I'm writing from a particular that is my particular, but I'm not writing from the particular to the particular. I'm writing from the particular to the universal, I hope. But this question of being read as, oh, here's a particular to a particular, like, oh, this is particularly about Islam. Well, no, it's particularly about the universal experience, I hope, of faith and love and greed and murder and all these other things. And it just happens to take place with a character set of that are happen to be Muslim American. But well, yes, the this book is a response to all of that.
And the narrative voice in this book and the narrative structure, the choices you made novelistically grant you that space. And you take it. And that's part of the... that's part of the pulse of the whole book, I think. So I want to just focus a little bit on one section of the book. The chapter is titled Scranton Memoirs. And yeah. I would call it a watershed section. You know, very roughly, you're coming back from a few days with your parents at this resort they go to in the Finger Lakes, and your car breaks down near Scranton, and you're pulled over with your smoking engine by a state trooper, and it leads to an incident between the two of you, or a conversation, and then that leads through the byways of American local behaviors to your being at an auto shop a couple of towns over with a guy who turns out to be the uncle of the policeman who stopped you, and you get into a situation. So it's a yes, troubling yes. situation, and as you leave through, there are a number of byways in the chapter, but as you're heading finally with your engine fixed, some degree poorer, you're driving back finally to the city, you say a couple of things, and it seems to be a moment when, at least in the novel, and this is the leap I would like you to talk about, you cross over as an artist and a novel towards an idea about what you don't want to do and what you do. Here's one quote. So, as much as I felt victim to what the nation had become for us after 9/11, I too had participated in my own exclusion, willingly, still choosing some 40 years into my American life to see myself as other. You make reference to the rootless, haunted sense of having foundered in my life as an American. And then at the very end of the chapter, you say, I would soon begin a series of works founded on my new unwillingness to pretend I was not conflicted about my country or my place in it. So I yeah. guess with that and the addition of a little epigraph you lead to, and I'm a huge D.W. Winnicott fan, that epigraph is, it is a joy to be hidden, but a disaster not to be found. So with those yeah. quotes in mind and that chapter yeah. in mind as you leave out of it and head into a chapter that's called Riaz or the Merchant of Debt, all about American yeah. capital, to what degree is that representative, I would ask, of perhaps a feeling you had about your own Americanness or your own role totally. In your own American life and whatever shift you felt you needed to make in order to start making art out of it?
Totally. I mean, you know, I think there's lots of, you know, we go through this constant process of sort of coming of age, right? Always. Mm-hmm. We're always coming of age in different ways. And I think that for me, the real potent coming of age was the ability to no longer need a solution, the ability to no longer need a resolution. Mm-hmm. And for some reason, the question or the quandary or the tension or the opposition was enough. And to have a space, a mental space and an emotional space to recognize that the question was actually much more interesting than the answer. You know, and it's led to all kinds of acquisitions at the level of craft when it comes to sort of focusing on the middle of a story where the story is not resolved, where we're still in the conflict, where, you know, I think as a writer when I was much younger, I wanted to get to the end as quickly as possible. Or I wanted to get to, you know, where's it going? Where is it all going? But I think, you know, keeping the reader in the where is it going, but we don't know, you know, the match that we're not sure which side is winning yet. That's a much more vivid and interesting place. And so similarly, getting back to the question you just asked me, I think there came a moment in my career and in my as a writer in my own sort of life that the question of being divided about my belonging in this country was no longer something that was seeking to be resolved. Yeah. And when it was no longer seeking to be resolved, it could just be what it was, and it started to sprout and generate story itself.
Right.
And that's the moment that I'm fashioning, that I'm, you know, yeah. that I'm creating for the reader in that section.
And that is the beginning, because art, of course, is not an answer to anything.
Yeah, it's, you know, that great thing that Keats says about negative capability, you know. Yeah.
So speaking of Riaz or the Merchant of Debt, I know that you are fascinated/horrified by the American capital, the American relationship with capitalism, the origin stories of how we financially and immorally came to be where we are. You and I have talked a lot about stories from the 80s. Your play Junk takes the stories, the rise of Michael Milken and Boesky and that whole period, and it turns it into a fantastic play. So I would say, and there's a big chapter here called Riaz or the Merchant of Debt, and Riaz is a Pakistani who becomes a very, very successful financier in America, and you end up, he befriends you or you befriend him, and you end up becoming, entering his world for a while and profiting from it. So I would ask, how would you describe your own relationship to money coming from where you came from with your father, your Trump-loving father, who also made money and lost money, and how that in your own mind has connected you as you have written these works to America's relationship to money as it is now?
I think the book circles around, you know, it tries to portray a very rich, as rich as I could summon, a portrait of the country. And at the center of that portrait, really, you know, all of the pieces of that portrait are revolving around a center, and that center is the American relationship to money. And the final section, you know, is called Pax Americana, and is kind of centers in on what the disease, if the republic is diseased, what is that disease? And I think the book makes a case that the disease is our relationship to money, which you know, the book ends with referring to Whitman's, Democratic Vistas, having seen this, 100 years earlier. So it's not new. But I think that, as a student of the markets, as a student of the American project from an economic point of view, and as somebody who understands, I think, perhaps how American dominance, ideological dominance, has really been fundamentally about American economic prosperity over the past, 80 years. And no matter what our ideas, if we are not a dominant economic force in the future, our ideas are going to be irrelevant. It won't matter what our ideas are. Is to understand the basis of American strength has always ultimately really been not ideological, but economic. And to me, as a writer who thinks about this a lot, as you are, and as somebody who tries to make personal sense of all of it, I think that I can't do any better than to just sort of say it's very easy to criticize capitalism and it's very easy to enjoy its benefits. And, maybe even easier to enjoy its benefits. So I think that dilemma of being American, trying to understand what's going wrong, recognizing that what's going wrong has to do with our economics and the way that we think about money in this country, and also recognizing that I, as an American, am fully beholden to that mythology, and I'm a part of it. And so staging all of that and finding a way to stage all of it, the section that you're talking about, The Merchant of Debt, is all about how I, as you said, become part of a billionaire's or near billionaire's world and life, and what changes that wreaks on my consciousness, and what I learn and don't and sort of forget about being an artist, really, in that process. And then there's a consequence, later on in the book, there are lots of metaphorical and actual consequences to this encounter that that play themselves out.
And you fold race into that as well, which I find really, really interesting. The sort of internalized perceptions of it. It's between talking about the character of Riaz and a character, it's almost an essay about a character named Mike, who is a African-American big agent in Hollywood. And
who is a Trump supporter.
Yes, who's a Trump supporter. And so, and then you talk at a certain point about, I'll call him the narrator, about his own perceptions as experienced through relationships with women in particular, but of his own skin color and his internalized perceptions of his own race, and also those its connections with sex as well, and the whole sense of how he's perceived and how it has shaped him, and then how money relates to that, and whether or not people of color, what it looks like in this country when people of color have money. And right. So I find all that that's the part in a way that links it so organically with those sections in the beginning and where you came from.
You know, it's interesting in hearing you talk about it. It sort of occurs to me that, you know, it's hard to describe what the structure of the book is to those. I think it's much easier to experience as a read than it is to describe what it really is in any kind of like clear sense. But if sort of hearing you talk about it, I'm like, yeah, right.
Yeah,
it's
that
about
makes sense.
It's about father. Then it's about mother. Then it's about the prophet. Then it's about the law. Then it's about money. Then it's about love and sex. Then it's about race and politics. And finally, it's about love.
There's your book tour. We got it.
Well, I'm just saying those are the slalom gates that the story is sort of, you know, racing through. And yes, in the midst of it, all of these things that you're talking about, you know, the effect of race and how money and race are intertwined in this country, and what belonging, you know, what does it mean to finally achieve American belonging? Well, isn't that about money? Isn't that about making it? When you make it, that you, in a sense, finally do belong?
Well, that goes back to your parents and you being a struggling writer for so many years and all of that, which brings me, having gone through all of those doorways in this story, I want to lead back to what reactions you can anticipate over these coming weeks about what you have just written and are publishing.
You know, there's a sort of a family friend, just not direct family, who had read an early copy of the book and emailed me at 6 a.m. one morning. You know, I love it. It's wonderful. I couldn't put it down, but I need to talk to you. emailed her back and said, can you talk this morning? She's like, yeah, I can talk right now. I called and basically, you know, said, you can't let this book go out the way it is. You can't say these things about the prophet, and you gotta take them out. And, you know, and it was just the sort of beginning of a kind of taste of what was ahead. You know, people who are going to, you know, be upset about the things that I've written about my father, and you know, certainly, and maybe less so about my mom, but to the same degree. And you know, a lot of consternation and maybe outrage and perhaps even wrath about some of the stuff that I say about the prophet. And then, you know, to sort of like not even get into what I say about myself. So,
yes.
And what, how that's going to be reflected by readers and people who come to the book are hoping for some representation of Muslim American identity or, you know, Pakistani American experience, and want something redemptive, or they want something really positive. And, you know, and then, you know, the extent to which, if there's any kind of like praise or their accolades or anything like that, is like, you know, the accusation that I'm throwing myself and my own people under the bus for, you know, some personal gain of some sort, you know, all things which I've been dealing with over the years. But I worry that all of that has just been like, you know, it's just been sort of scattered showers, and that the thunderstorm.
Well, this brings it all together. So it is now. If anyone hasn't reacted in the past, this is something for everybody, pretty much. But it's like an all you can eat buffet. But you know, that I wonder if you don't have a concurrent hope, aside from the book doing well and all the rest of that, but of a reaction from at least certain individuals out there in your family, and of being understood in a way you never have before, because you do bring so much to this, and you obviously express certain things that you haven't. And I mean, that will be really interesting to see if there aren't people in your family who somehow have not felt able to express their own thoughts, who see in yours you know, some echo of what they themselves have felt at different times.
Well, I think the thing I'd say about that is just that I don't think I've ever had the experience before, John, that, you know, writing a book or writing a play or writing something really fundamentally transformed me. Mm-hmm. And I think in some way writing this book changed something inside me that I didn't know needed changing, but I think it probably did need changing, or was yearning for that change. It solidified something in me. Mm-hmm. It took a long time to get here, but I think speaking this way, speaking this directly, speaking this with this much sort of freedom, you know, freedom earned from years and years of craft, I think, has made something clear to me about what my place is as an artist and as a writer and what it means for me to do what it is that I do. And I'm not sure I could articulate in any better terms what any of that is. It's yeah. really just a feeling more than it is some kind of idea or meaning.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's really true. And doing it in the wake of the loss of one's parents at that particular time in one's life, it's the right time. You know, you've been working yeah. for it all that time. There's a line you quote from Mary Moroney, the professor in the book. She says, right when you're first studying with her, and she says, use the difficulty, make it your own.
Yeah.
And you have really done that here, and you've made it art. And, you know, as a reader, I'm grateful. As a friend, I'm full of admiration. So I can't thank you enough for hopping on the phone, as it were, with me.
Anything for Sun Valley. I missed the fact that we weren't in Sun Valley this summer.
It was rough.
It's the highlight of my year.
Yeah, looking forward to next summer with fingers crossed.
Yeah.
And wishing you great success with this amazing book.
Thank you, John. Thank you. Thank you for having me.
We hope you've enjoyed this episode of Beyond the Page. You can catch previous podcast episodes as well as installments of SVWC Now, our series of video conversations, at lithub.com or at the Sun Valley Writers Conference website, svwc.com. I'm John Burnham Schwartz. Thanks so much for listening.
Beyond the Page is produced by John Burnham Schwartz and James Tooley. Original music by Dean Grinsfelder, and production support provided by Jay Shilliday and the Network Studios.